Today on Shipment from Shiloh, Ben and I share our best practices for teaching Netrunner to new players. We discuss decks, progression, and strategies for a successful first-time experience. Finally, Ben installs the most expensive card in Netrunner in the Jank Tank. All this and more on Shipment from Shiloh. And welcome to Shipment from Shiloh, a Netrunner community podcast. I'm your host, Graham, and joining me today, all the way down from the University of Illinois, Ben, what's going on, dude?
Hey, how's it going?
It's great. Thank you so much for joining me. Today's episode is all about teaching Netrunner because I don't think I've known anyone else who has taught more people the game than Ben. And I don't want to hype him up too much, but he's a pretty big deal.
I counted it up, and it's like 11 or 12 people that I've taught the game.
Wow. I cannot even count up to 12 on two hands. That is a lot of people.
All right. To be fair, like, that's counting the people that taught because I was the one that bought the core set, so I hadn't played any games yet either.
But, yeah, yeah. So... But that still counts. It still counts. It's good.
Yeah, it still counts.
All right, okay. Well, let's get this party on the road. First, Ben, the people want to know, who the heck are you? So we're going to kick this off with a segment called Searchlight. So, Ben, I want to know, how did you first get involved with Netrunner? What's your gaming history like?
Okay. Probably, like... I started with Dominion, and I've slowly built up a large collection of board games, largely through like following the Shut Up and Sit Down website. They're board so game good. Reviewers, and one of them really, really, really loved Netrunner a lot. Mm-hmm. I was very intrigued because of how enthusiastic he was.
Sure.
So that was basically what made me decide to pick it up, because I trusted the recommendations in general, and that was the heartiest of recommendations.
Yeah. Quinn's was really invested, I think, in Netrunner for a little bit there, and he persuaded a lot of people to get into the game, I think.
Yeah. He sort of made one of the first successful Gagarin decks and brought it to their British Nationals.
Yeah. He did pretty well. I think he made the cut with that.
Yeah.
So what is it that you like about Netrunner? Like, what makes Netrunner unique as a game to you?
Definitely how thematic everything is. And that's, like, been my answer to this question for a long time. But, like, I was thinking about it yesterday, and it even when it feels like you're sort of getting away from the theme of the game and taking off your cyberpunk boots and whatnot, and just thinking about how efficient is this card, what decks might I be up against, and what strategies we'll have to think of counterplays for. Even that, like, it emulates the real world cybersecurity hacking scene, where corporations think about common lines of attack that Netrunners hackers take. Mm. And how to play against them, and you think about what programs you can get the most utility from for the least investment. So you think about things the same way that either the corporation or the runner would. And really, all of the in-game actions feel very, very thematic. Like, it feels like you're installing programs and you're worrying about your time and money. And it feels like hacking into a server.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what defenses you're gonna run up against, and it's really, really exciting. It's just really immersive and tactically engaging.
Yeah, definitely. Now the mechanics of Netrunner are so fluid and they're so well intertwined with the theme of the game. So when you are actually spending time doing jobs for Katie Jones, and then you're collecting that paycheck. Like, that fits so perfectly in with that card. Or, you know, if you are the corporation and you are spending your time and money advancing your nefarious agendas, like, it's just perfect.
Yeah, or even, like, what's an example of a totally non-intuitive card interaction? Can you think of one off the top of your head?
Oh, gosh.
Maybe something like Data Raven into Quantum Predictive Model.
Okay.
Quantum Predictive Model is a NBN agenda that when the runner accesses it, if he's tagged, the corp scores the agenda instead of the runner.
Mm-hmm.
And Data Raven is a corset NBN ice that gives the runner a tag on encounter.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put the Data Raven in front of the predictive model, then you'll tag the runner, and then when he accesses your agenda, you score it.
Mm-hmm.
So like something like that, it's hard to think of like an in-world what exactly is happening there.
Sure.
But it's still thematic for the way that hackers and cybersecurity specialists think about the interaction of programs, because it's totally commonplace circumstance for some piece of code to have a really unintuitive, unforeseen interaction with another piece of code. And for the cybersecurity specialist or the hacker to think of a way to exploit that.
Sure, sure.
So even the unintuitive card combination totally work.
Right. So what are some of your favorite decks to play? What strategies in Netrunner do you like? What do you gravitate towards?
I gravitate towards things that I don't see being played, which is just explicitly hipster and disgusting.
Hipster trash.
Yeah, but I have a lot of fun seeing people's reactions when I play a card that they don't normally see played. If I like, I get a lot of joy out of doing something that the other person doesn't expect, even if it isn't actually something that's really that good for me.
Yeah.
Like, it was a long time before I decided not to fire an accelerated beta test when I scored it.
Because it's optional, except that it shouldn't be, because you should always be triggering the ABT.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, cool. Now that we have gotten to know you a little bit more, Ben, I want to hear all about your experiences teaching people and what some of the strategies are that you have for teaching Netrunner to new players. And we're going to do that in a segment called Recruiting Trip. Okay, Ben, so any discussion of teaching Netrunner, I think, has to start with what decks you use to teach people the game. And there's several ideas floating around online. First, let's talk about the basic decks that you build with just the core set, which is all of the cards from one faction plus the neutrals. Do you like those? Do you not like those?
That's what I learned.
That's what I learned from, too.
Yeah, I think that there's some key failings of most of those decks.
Sure.
it's no fun. It's less fun to play a crappy deck when you're trying to learn the game. And then the other side of where those decks aren't great for learning is they aren't using like the bare minimum number of concepts.
Sure.
Like the Wayland deck, it has Scorched Earth. So you have to think about what damage is. And, like, the Jinteki deck, it's, like, full of hidden information that only really works if you have some knowledge with the card.
Right.
And that kind of sucks for learning the game. The NBN deck, like, traces, I'd like to play without traces for someone's first game, because it's just a concept that you can play without. Like, Core Netrunner doesn't need a trace.
Sure.
And HB... people tend to get very confused by clicking through ice when they're first learning. So,
Right.
Let's get rid
you
of
know,
that
you
as well.
Tell them you need an icebreaker to break through the subroutines on an ice, except for in these situations when you don't. And it's like you don't need to introduce exceptions like that right off the bat.
Yeah, you want as few exceptions as possible. So the decks that I use are for the first game that I teach to somebody. The decks that I use are from a Netrunner DB user called Onaya, O-N-I-Y-A. And I've slightly tweaked them both. She built them using just one core set each.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dipped a little bit into the Genesis cycle cards to stay a little bit truer to that vision of keeping the game as simple as possible.
Right, right. Now, I've got links to these decks in the show description, but Ben, just give me a couple highlights. Why do you like using Onaya's teaching decks?
Right. So the person who's learning the game plays Runner. You can't. It's really bad to try to play Court the first time you play Netrunner because you're trying to play this hidden information game without any idea of how the runner's really going to come at you.
Mm-hmm.
It's much harder to do that without knowledge than it is to just slowly draw into the tools that you can use and mm-hmm. play them and attack and see what happens. So the new player plays Runner.
Okay.
So what I like about the decks is the Court, it's Wayland, building a better world. Like, most of the ice is just end the run ice, I think. And so it's just straightforward. They're like, ice or obstacles, okay. Because that's like a very common misconception that I will like address later is it's okay to let subroutines fire sometimes. Like, it isn't mm-hmm. guaranteed to stop the run. You can choose some subroutines to break.
Okay, so it's all end the run ice. It's very simple. Obviously not that porous. So they're really just trying to find icebreakers to deal with whatever the barriers are that they've got.
Yeah, the game is 100% about finding your icebreakers and playing your outs while you're trying to find your icebreaker.
Interesting.
The runner will find their icebreakers eventually, and at that point, it becomes about windows.
Yeah.
Because something that happens with this matchup that doesn't happen with other matchups is I will easily spend 20-25 credits on ice because they have Magnum Opus and they have their breakers and I don't have any tricks
besides what?
Ice.
Oh yeah, so you're just literally just trying to tax them out
basically. Yeah. The Wayland deck is worse than the Kate deck, but I don't take it easy at all on purpose. So it's sort of a built-in handicap.
So with that Wayland deck, how do they create scoring windows then? Do they have like an advanceable trap or not really?
No. It's literally just I wait until they're low on money or if I have the right kind of ice to put in front of the server
mm-hmm.
and slap down the agenda and advance one or two times if it's a priority requisition or a private security force.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, the strategy to playing the Wayland is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, but again, it's an intro game, so that's fine.
Yeah, that is the idea, because Netrunner is not a straightforward game.
Right.
So the more straightforward you can make this intro game, the better.
Right.
Because believe me, like, there are still issues of confusion.
So Onaya has the initial pairing of Kate versus Wayland, and then they have the intermediate level, which is Noise versus PE versus Personal Evolution.
I was using that for a little while once people got used to that first pairing, but both of those decks struggle with money, which like they're still balanced, but it's less fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of dropped those from my.
Gotcha.
From my training regimen.
Gotcha. So you mentioned that you made a couple changes for your own deck by adding in some additional cards not from the core set. What are some of those changes? What do you like about those?
So basically, for the Wayland deck, the only change is I took out Shadow, which has a trace,
mm-hmm.
and that's needlessly complicated,
mm-hmm.
and put in Rainbow.
Oh, cool.
Which is easy to break.
Right.
Rainbow is just a single sub end the run that has all three subtypes.
Right. So you can break it with any of your main breakers. I think it's warranted as a card because it's three to res, but it's four strength. So it usually costs like 3 to 4 credits every time to break, depending on what kind of breaker you're using.
Yeah. So you still aren't upset about resing it.
Right. Right. Now, it's just a good taxing piece of ice, but it's not, it's pretty hard to keep someone out with it. So
for sure.
Cool. Any other changes?
That's it for the Wayland deck. For the Kate deck, I put in Dirty Laundry because it sucks to be digging for money cards when you're already digging for icebreakers.
Yeah.
And same old thing, because one of the major win conditions of the Kate deck is Maker's Eye. So you can play that extra times.
Oh, yeah. That's smart.
And that is kind of the anatomy of how I set up the first game, I guess.
Sure, sure. So I have a couple of teaching decks that I've used when I've taught people, and it's very similar to that Onaya matchup of Kate versus Wayland. I really like using the core Wayland ice, or core Wayland as the corp for like a very first introductory game.
Because
it's very direct. You're just
trying to slap down ice.
Right.
As long as you take out Scorched Earth, you know?
Right, exactly. Well, also a problem with a regular core Wayland is that if you're only using Wayland cards, it's basically impossible to tag the runner, which means Scorched Earth doesn't do anything. You're introducing the concepts of damage and tags.
Shadow,
I think, is the only one. So they have to hit a shadow, lose the trace, and then not clear the tags from Shadow or Hunter.
It's a bad deck for Scorched Earth.
Right, right. So, in my Wayland deck, I'm using lots of... first of all, with my teaching decks, I've just pulled from the entire card pool. So, it's not limited to just core set cards. Yeah, so I've pulled in a couple of cards to balance out the ice suite and the economy. So, I feel like the core set decks are really, really poor. And I remember feeling really frustrated as a new player when I had all these cards in my hand and I couldn't play any of them because I didn't have any money.
Definitely.
And although, you know, balancing your economy is a core part of playing Netrunner, I don't think you should be penalized for not knowing how to do that in your first couple games.
Yeah, yeah. You can make it easier at the beginning.
Right, right, exactly. So I'm running the Pad Campaign, the Beanstalk, and the Hedge Fund, but this is in core set Wayland, Building a Better World, so it's easier to get into double digits. So I've also included two Restructure.
Okay.
And then I also have two Grundle Refineries, and that is to try to show how the hidden information is relevant. And so when I sit someone down for
killing the runner,
right, right, exactly. So you can make an advanceable trap, quote unquote, to make them run through the remote. But if they hit it, it's just like, oh, I didn't need to. I didn't need to spend all those resources. So then the corp learns how to make a taxing remote, so that if they trick the runner into running it, they get some benefit out of it. If the runner doesn't run it, then they get punished because the corp then gets a bunch of money. For those of you who don't remember, Grundle Refinery is a facility asset that's advanceable, and it has an ability on there. Click and trash, gain 4 credits for each advancement token that's on Grundle Refinery.
Okay.
So that's what we're talking about here. I also put in a couple of matrix analyzers, which is the ice that when you... It's a core set NBN ice. When the runner encounters it, the corp can pay one to put an advancement counter on an installed card.
Yeah.
So that...
Super fun encounter ability.
Yeah, really interesting. In theory, it could be used for like an agenda if you happen to have it when they run past it. But most of the time, you're going to want to put it on ice. And the advanceable ice, I think, is good for teaching because... it kind of puts more focus on the icebreaker strength versus ice strength interaction.
Yeah.
And then it also gives the corp more ways to try to tax the runner out of running through that remote.
Man, why isn't Matrix Analyzer in my Space Ice deck?
I don't know, man. It's Matrix Analyzers, almost OP. Gotta ban that.
It's interesting. So your style is more willing to put more concepts in there, but you're showcasing them all in a very purposeful way. That
yeah, it's controlled. There's nothing that says, "Oh, if you didn't expect this, you're basically going to lose." You know.
Yeah.
I also put in 2 experiential data, which is an upgrade that is in the core set. It's from HB. It's only 1 influence, and all ice protecting the server experiential data is in has +1 strength. So it's the same kind of thing where you're reinforcing that icebreaker strength, ice strength interaction.
That's another concept that I didn't want to include in my first matchup is upgrades. Because it's much easier to think, okay, you put a card in the server, it's either an asset or an agenda.
Oh, sure.
Instead of, but you already have a card in that server? And then I have to explain, that either means that this card that I put in was an upgrade, or the first one was an upgrade, or maybe they're both upgrades, because there's this whole complicated relationship where there's sort of a main slot that can either be an asset or an agenda, and then you can also have as many upgrades in there as you want, but it looks like an asset or an agenda if you have just an upgrade in there.
Sure, sure.
And just when you're trying to learn everything else, that when I offer that explanation during an early game for someone, like I see the confusion on their face, and then I see them like think, okay, I'm going to stop thinking about that for now.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of this extra hurdle mentally that you maybe didn't even need to present to them yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So my Kate deck is not particularly interesting. It uses Magnum Opus. I put in Easy Marg because it's really easy to say, like, oh, I have 4 credits, and I have this Gordian Blade in my hand, so I will just install Gordian Blade. Great. And but now, even with my Kate discount, I'm down to just 1 credit.
Yeah.
I can't play anything else, so now I'm just clicking for credits. So, like, Easy Mark is particularly easy for new players to play, so I like that. I also put in Daily Chaos as an economy option. Again,
yeah, I did that. No, I didn't. I thought I did for a second.
You might have. I don't know.
No. I'm looking at it now. It is not there.
But yeah, anything that I can do to help the new player have fun. Like, it is fun to say, I have lots of money, so I can play lots of cards. Like, that's just a very intuitive, fun thing. So, I think more money is good.
Yeah, yeah.
But the only other interesting thing about my Kate deck is that I have in Comet as the console instead of the toolbox.
Okay, I can't think of what that is at all.
The Comet is a 4-credit console that gives you a memory, and then the first time that you play an event every turn, you can play another event. And it's just a very simple effect where, again, new players can have a lot of fun because you play an event and you're like, oh, cool, and then I get to do my Comet thing, and I play another event. And it's like I got 5 clicks, which it's kind of not, but being able to put together those kinds of combos and say, I don't think I can get into R&D right now, but I can play I can play Sure Gamble to get enough money, and then I'll play this Tinkering on this Innermost Ice because my Century Breakers suck, so now I can break this Century with Gordian Blade, and then I can play Maker's Eye, and I did all of that in 2 clicks, right? So they just feel really cool.
Yeah, that's really good. I should think about trying to switch out the toolbox. I guess with the teaching decks, when someone's like comfortable with playing Shaper against Wayland, the Wayland deck is much worse than the Shaper deck. So what I don't actually want to do is just switch sides. So I have a second corp that is competitive for somebody that understands how to play the game at least. And that's as close to core set as I can manage HB. So that introduces a couple of new things, like you could click through some ice. There are upgrades in it. There's San City Grid. So there's the whole fast advanced threat. And then when they're actually switching sides and start playing corp, that's a deck that they can actually win with.
Right.
It's very difficult to win with that Wayland deck.
Right. It's very difficult to win.
Yeah. So that is the progression that gotcha. I like to use.
I have an HB teaching deck as well, and it's probably just like yours, where it's pretty basic and it just uses all of the core set ice. Mm-hmm. I do have two copies of Aggressive Secretary in there, and
yeah.
If I play someone with that and they're a new player, I will show them the card ahead of time.
Definitely.
And say, hey, if I advance a card in here, I might be trying to destroy your programs.
Yeah.
So that means either hold on to your extra programs in your hand in case you hit an Aggressive Secretary, or if you are afraid of running this, think about where else you could run. And I'll just tell them that up front.
Yeah.
And I give them, like, you have option A or option B. It's up to you.
Right.
So they feel like they have some counterplay.
I did that. I had Aggressive Secretary in there, and I decided to cut it in favor of Jackson Howard because this is a deck with 10 agendas that is very you're very capable of getting flooded.
Yeah.
And so it's much more fun for when the new player starts playing Corp to have an answer to flooding.
Right.
That is such a source of frustration.
It can be. It definitely can be. And it just kind of comes down to luck. So for a game that's so strategy intensive, it's really frustrating to have a bunch of cards that not only make you vulnerable in your hand, but you have no other options because those are your only cards.
Yeah.
I will say that in all my teaching Corp decks, I've been putting in Corporate Sales Team, the 4-for-2 that when you score it, you put 10 credits on it, and at the start of each player's turn, you get to take a credit off. And again, that just goes into that you want to have lots of money so that it feels like you're having fun kind of thing. Because it's just a good agenda.
Definitely.
Cool. So you've picked out your decks... and you're sitting down at the table with your friend and you're saying, okay, I'm going to teach you Netrunner.
Yeah.
What do you say first? I have like a 30-second elevator speech for Netrunner that I've used more often at like a bar or something, right? Where someone comes up and they're like, what the hell is this? Is this Magic?
Right.
It's Netrunner and it's like Magic, but better.
I have definitely stolen parts of your elevator speech, which I've heard you give at bars.
Because we play at bars together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for listeners, my little spiel is, so Netrunner is a game where one person is playing a futuristic corporation of the future, and the other person is a hacker who's trying to hack into the corporation's servers. It's an interesting game because it's 1-to-7 points, but the corporation deck is the only deck that has point cards. So the hacker has to interact with the corporation's cards to then steal those points away from them. Meanwhile, the corporation is laying down cards to protect their points from being stolen. And that's basically what I tell someone who has no concept for what the game is. And that's about the attention span that you can give someone without getting in to be much more technical than that.
It's a good elevator speech. I think the main parts that I've taken from that are the initial setting the stage, corporation versus runner. Mm-hmm. I say it a little bit differently because they're sitting down to be the runner. So like I hand them the runner deck. I'm like, okay. You're Kate, hacker extraordinaire. This is the future, and corporations have taken over the world. I'm Wayland Consortium from the Alien series. and I'm evil. Also, just the emphasis that you use with... it's 1-to-7 points, but all the points start in my deck, so you have to go and find them.
Yeah.
I explain how I get points, and then I explain how they get points. And because the game is essentially playing on... the board that the corporation builds. I explain what the corporation board looks like first. So servers, what cards go in servers, and then finally what cards protect servers.
Right. When I'm explaining what a server is, I usually say that the corpse cards are organized in columns. And when I put it like that, that kind of gives a framework for someone. So they say, okay, the deck is called R&D, and that's at the bottom of a column.
Yeah.
You can put these horizontal cards in front of it, which will defend your deck. And if you put a card down on the table that's like an asset or an agenda, that makes a new column. So you're sitting down, you're kind of explaining how the corp sets up the game board. What do you tell them next?
Usually when I explain how I protect my servers, like I say how they would hack into a Snow Ice. And then I say, I don't want that, and here's how I stop it from doing that. So I explain what ice are, and usually they'll ask, well, how do I get through your ice? Which is the perfect segue at the perfect time to their deck.
Right.
So then I explain their icebreakers versus the three kinds of ice, and then I explain their rig, and then I explain that you get four clicks per turn, and I get three. And these are the things that you can do with your clicks every time you use them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I usually ask if they have any questions, and we're ready to start.
Yeah. So that's a pretty bare bones beginning, and I think that's important because there's so much information in Netrunner in the first place, and you really don't want to front load them with too much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So something that I've seen people do is try to translate all of the Netrunner jargon right at the beginning and say, okay, on your turn, you have four actions called clicks, and you can use that to get money called credits. And then you're going to draw from your deck, which is called your stack. And then when you discard a card, you put it into your discard pile, which is called a heap. And
just one after another like that is probably not the most efficient way.
It's just rapid fire.
Get it all across.
It's like memorization, like just organic chemistry. The first 2 months of organic chemistry is just rote memorization, and that's what it's like.
Yeah.
So to avoid that, I just use common terms. This is your deck. I don't call it a stack. It's just, this is your deck. This is my deck. This is your discard pile. This is your hand. And you're going to lay cards on the table. And this server here forms a column. So this column of cards, you know, that kind of stuff. So then when we're playing, I can use the terminology as I do the actions that they're familiar with. So I will say, okay, for my first click, I will play Sure Gamble or Hedge Fund or whatever.
Right. That's a good strategy.
So they just pick it up from kind of watching me. But they'll usually still say, okay, so action one, I'm going to play Sure Gamble. Or action two, I will play Gordian Blade.
And,
you know, and I don't correct them on any of the terminology because it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. My approach to that whole issue of Netrunner has its own language is, you know, part of what I sell, of how I try to sell the game is how like immersive it is, right?
Right.
The language is good for that. So there's a few of them that I will, there are four, I think, that I bring up in the before game explanation. When I'm explaining what servers are, I say that my deck is research and development because those are plans that are working on that my company is working on and will eventually be coming to me. My hand is my headquarters because those are the things that are here right now. And I think just like giving that thematic explanation helps those term equations stick better.
Yeah.
And then the only other two are right at the end of the explanation when I say, here is a turn structure. You basically have time and money in this game or clicks and credits. And so those are I think the four that that I talk about before the game starts.
Nice. So once you start playing a game, what are some things that you talk to them about? Do you like coach them on what they should be doing, or do you just kind of let them explore? What do you do?
So yeah, like I'll do my first turn, which is usually getting some money and putting an ice down. Then I'll say, like, it's your turn, and I'll let them think about it for a second. When I give advice, I start as generic as possible and then continue if the confusion persists. So, like, I usually start with, so you want to find the agendas, and right now they're either in my hand or my deck. and my deck is protected right now. So you can try to get through that. Maybe you'll fail. But my hand is unprotected right now, so you could hit that. And basically everything you want to be doing in this game is either attacking me or playing cards that will make you better at attacking me in the future.
Right. I really like the focus of that approach because, you know, although a more skilled player might try to weigh the tempo loss of trying to hit a 1 in 5 maybe agenda from your hand versus trying to set up their rig.
Yeah.
That's several steps beyond where a new player should be at. So just trying to encourage them to interact with you more. And
definitely.
You know, I think that approach is better.
Players are afraid of unres dice.
Mm-hmm. When I've coached people before, first of all, if you're playing with like a mulligan type strategy, I will just say like, all right, you take a mulligan if you don't have any money cards in your hand. Like, that's basically what I'd say.
Yeah.
So then if it's their first turn, I'll say, all right, first click, do you have Sure Gamble? And then 1/3 of the time they will say yes. And I will say, okay, play Sure Gamble. Great. Good start.
Yeah.
And then I usually try to get them to spend a click to draw if they're not at their maximum hand size and they don't know what to do. And that's just because it's a good habit to draw up to see what your options are.
Beyond that, I kind of try to let them figure out as much as possible themselves, because it's definitely like a true thing that you understand something when you figure it out a lot better than when it's told to you.
Ah, yeah. You don't want to play the game for them, because if you're giving them too much specific advice, then they will never learn.
Yeah, so it's a tricky balance, I guess. Because if you just give them no information over the course of the game, then they're just lost the entire time and it's no fun.
Right.
So yeah, I guess my whole approach while we're playing the game is to try to let them figure out as much as possible, but give information when it's needed. So that's why I wait until I can tell that they're confused, and then start with broad advice and slowly get more specific.
Yeah. So what are some common things that you run into when you're teaching new players? What are some common misconceptions that they might have about the game or the rules?
One that I have literally never not seen is thinking that you have to choose an icebreaker to take with you.
To take with you on the run?
I addressed that multiple times over the course of the explanation, but it still comes up because there's a lot to keep in mind as you're trying to understand this game.
Yeah.
And so in terms of preventing it, all you can really do is explain it beforehand, right?
Right.
And I try to explain everything in terms of first theme and mechanics second, including during the game when a question comes up. When someone asks, but you have 2 ice on that server and one of them's a barrier and one of them's... I'm like, yeah, and you are going to hack into my server with your entire computer. You have these 2 programs installed on your computer and you get to use them both because they're both installed. I try to emphasize how it makes sense thematically first, and hopefully that makes it stick.
Yeah. The first time that someone plays Corp, I've noticed a lot that, one, they will trash an ice after all the subroutines have been broken, which they don't have to do.
Yeah.
And then, two, they might forget to pay the install cost for ice, where you have to pay 1 credit if it's the second ice, 2 credits if it's the 3rd ice.
Definitely. That's a rule that I learned about, after I started buying cards outside the core set.
Oh, nice. Another thing I've seen is they think if they can't break the subroutines, it automatically ends the run.
Definitely. So,
common example would be something like Hunter, where there's 1 sub and it says trace 3, take a tag. So they hit that and they're like, okay, well, I guess I'll pay the couple credits because I don't want to be tagged. And then they just start looking in their hand to figure out what to play next. And it's like, no. Yeah. You continue the run because it didn't say end the run.
Yeah. That's one that I see all the time. But I think that the last time I taught, the new player understood they could continue the run without breaking all the subroutines because of Enigma. If you run on Enigma last click, you only have to break one of the subroutines and you can let the other one fire.
Oh, sure.
When I was addressing the concept of ice at the beginning, before we started playing, I was like, okay, so the ice are my defensive programs and these L-shaped arrows are its subroutines. And it will just try to do what the subroutines say to do and nothing else. So it doesn't keep you out unless it is able to do a subroutine that keeps you out.
Sure.
And so I like kind of give that spiel again the first time I resonize, and it happened to be the Enigma on R&D in that case, and the new runner happened to be running last click. So she figured out that, oh, so I can let this I lose a click of Able subroutine fire and I won't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me really happy because she figured that part out on her own, which was great.
Yeah, that's great. So you've played, let's say that you've played a game where, let's say you've played your first game with a person. They seem to enjoy it. Do you mm-hmm. switch sides or no?
Usually they're pretty exhausted by the end of the first game because the process of learning and playing out one whole game takes about an hour and a half.
Sure.
So for the next game, it's usually, you know, some number of days later, and it's going to be the same matchup, but they're better at it this time.
Right. You kind of reinforce all the stuff that they learned from last time because their second game is just going to be trying to remember as much as they can from the first time they played.
Yeah, exactly. Like the second time we play faster, I say less, and they usually crush me because all my only defense is taxing them out, which is hard to do when you have Magnum Opus on the table.
Right, right. And that might not force them to learn particularly like high-end strategies if they're playing against a particularly bad deck. But right. That's not the point of this right now, right? The point of it is just to have fun.
And, yeah. And if they crush me game two, it's like, hey, you've got the fundamentals. This is great. And, you know, everybody learns at their own pace. So some people I've played that first matchup like 6 or 7 times before trying something different.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are ready to try something different by the end of the second or even the first game.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my second game is Kate versus HB.
Okay. I really like keeping it on Kate for the first several games for them because then definitely. They know that, okay, I need to break a code gate, so I need to find my Gordian Blade. You know, they don't need to learn another faction.
Yeah, and you build that whole familiarity with a deck, which is a really important feeling for a deck-based game.
Mm-hmm. So then talk to me a little bit about someone where you've played these introductory games with them. Maybe they've played 2, 3, 4 times. So what kind of stuff do you start talking to them about then? Is that like when you try to get them to switch sides? Is that when you want them to try a different faction? Where do you go?
Yeah, I've got a friend that I'm kind of at that position right now where there are 4 decks that he's seen and played as.
Mm-hmm.
He's played as the Kate, the Wayland, which him playing as Wayland is when I decided that the new player should not play that deck because it's not very good. And as Gabe and as HB.
Nice.
Which is designed to be a winnable corp deck, so that's great. So I guess like what I'm trying to do there is slowly introduce more concepts. So upgrades and clicking through ice for the HB deck. He has to like realize that tags are a thing because Gabe has a count siphon. The only tag punishment that he's seen so far though is private security force. So like I tell him that, you know, tags are no big deal right now, but they are a thing that you have to worry about in the future.
Right.
And I can just, like, tap Private Security Force to do a damage because that feels bad, you know?
Right.
So being tagged feels bad, even though it's not going to really further my agenda.
Right. The biggest thing that I tell them about tags is there are cards that will really hurt you if you are tagged, but all corps can trash your resources with this trash your resource action.
Exactly. Like everything else in the game, it makes sense when you explain it, like, by what it means in universe. Mm-hmm. It means we figured out where you are in the real world, so we can spend resources to destroy the things that you have in physical space, or even kill you in principle if that's the kind of corporation we are. But you're playing Haas Bioroid right now, and they're not that kind of corporation.
Right. So I taught a couple friends of mine how to play Netrunner. They're a married couple, Melissa and Greg. What up, Greg? He listens to this podcast. And awesome. So I taught them how to play.
Hi, Greg.
hey, Greg. Ben says hi. I taught them how to play Netrunner, and when I did, I was just third wheeling it. Like, it was Melissa as the runner, Greg as the corp, and I was sitting.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was a unique experience because normally you don't get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
And so then what I could do is, like, go back and forth and look at their hands and say, like, okay, well, you want more money because you're only on 3 credits, so you should play this Armitage code busting, you know.
Yeah. That would be so good, because, like, when you're teaching someone the game, you don't really get the chance to play over the shoulder like that.
Right. Right. I think they had a really good time playing it.
Yeah.
So after they had played a couple times, I think Melissa was feeling kind of frustrated because she would draw and draw and try to find breakers, because now she understood, like, oh, I need to get past this wall of static, and so I can't really do anything until I find my, I think battering ram was her battering breaker. So then I was like, well, we can start to tweak your deck. And so then I put it out in the corner of the Kate deck. I said, see how it says 45-15? So 45 is the minimum number of cards you can have in your deck. And they're like, not the maximum? No, it's the minimum, because it's actually like a consistency thing. So just know that. And then 15 is the number of dots that you can have from non-shaper cards, or non-green cards, I think is what I said.
Yeah.
They're like, dots? And I said, yeah. So look at Easy Mark. See how it has a dot here? This is a blue card. It's not green.
Oh my
so
gosh.
It counts towards your 15 dots.
So you were like trying influence. To get them to deck building by like game 2?
Well, this is more like game 4.
Okay.
But I brought that up because I said, now, Melissa, if there's stuff that you don't like in this deck, let's just take it out and put stuff in there that you like. So we ended up putting in a pair of Special Order.
Nice.
And so when I did deck building with her, I just laid out like the different cards on the table. And rather than have her read through the rest of the core set cards, I would just pull up specific things that I thought she would like.
Okay.
And
nice.
So I just said,
oh, that's cool.
Here's 2 Special Order. Now that you've played, you know that Special Order can search for that one time when you need your barrier breaker and you have to get past that wall of static. And she was like, I know exactly what you're talking about. I want them. Give them to me. Boom. Puts them in the deck.
Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, yeah.
My only thought for getting someone to the deck building stage was, like, I'm comfortable enough with that core set chunk of the card pool that I could just, like, hand them a core set and be like, okay, build a deck.
Right. Again, it was that over-the-shoulder experience where, you know, normally you don't necessarily get a chance to do that. But I helped Melissa tweak the core set deck because she was like, Sacrificial Construct? What? I don't need this. You know, a bunch of random cards that Net Shield. What? When is this ever going to come into play? Alrighty, hello and welcome to the Jank Tank, where we talk about a particularly unique, exciting, or innovative deck. And Ben, while we have you on the show, you know, I gotta have you talk about some decks that you've been up to. So, what are some of the things that you've been crafting here? You mentioned that Wayland deck.
Yeah, I've got like a pet idea of a Wayland deck that has yet to resemble anything playable. but basically, there's this ice called IRS, spelled IRERESS, I think, which is a 0-cost Wayland code gate. Like, I was looking through my binder, right, thinking, wow, all of Wayland's code gates suck. Can't I make any of these work? And then I saw IRS, and I thought the art was really cool because it's like a dirty gang of street kids on the internet. And it it says, IRS gains the subroutine, the runner loses one credit for every bad publicity that you have. So basically just cancels out your bad publicity for runs on that particular server.
Right.
But what if you had like 30 bad pub and you had two IRS in front of one server?
So then it would cost them three actual credits to get through the two ice.
Or if you had lots of bad pub, like one time I was able to rack up 20 bad pub.
Oh my God.
If there's two IRS in front of a server, they have to pay 20 to get into a server that costs you one to set up.
Well, yeah. I mean, technically that's pretty good.
Yeah, the thing is actually making that deck work is really, really bad. Today I had an idea that I'm going to eventually try to incorporate is there's a new ice called Loki that can essentially make it so you have more copies of IRS.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was the main problem with the deck is you can't have two copies of IRS in front of multiple servers.
Right, right.
So I'm going to try to do that.
What did you say you call this deck?
The puppy grinder, because the idea is to rack up as much bad publicity as possible. And what could possibly have more bad press than a corporation that grinds up puppies to make its products?
That is terrible, and I love it. But that's not the
one that we're going to talk about, because the idea, I've built multiple iterations of it, but the idea really hasn't gotten much further than that in terms of success.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's not what we're talking about today. Today, we're going to talk about a certain Shaper console that is kind of hard to play. You've kind of built your deck around getting this console out.
Yeah.
Go ahead, so tell me.
The question is, what's the best card in Netrunner? Obviously, the best card in Netrunner is the most expensive card in Netrunner.
That's just what's how it that? Works. That's just math.
So that happens to be a Shaper console called Monolith, and it costs 18 credits. It gives you 3 extra memory, and when you install it, it lets you also install 3 programs, lowering the cost of each by 4. Which is so good. And then it has an additional ability where you can prevent brain damage or net damage by trashing a program from your grip.
Wow. There's so much utility there.
Yeah. You just have to get 18 credits and 3 programs in hand.
Right. Easy peasy. Well, normally that'd be pretty hard, but you found a way to make it easier, am I right?
Yeah. So for a while, the best deck at doing this was Big Girls Play with Monoliths, and it would sometimes get the monolith down fast enough to be relevant. And basically the way that it worked is if you put the monolith down, then your rig is completely set up. You're pretty good at that point. But before that, you're basically just trying to get to that point where you have 18 credits and 3 programs in hand, which can be difficult. And the main way that you do that is with a card called Freelance Coding Contract that lets you trash up to 5 programs from your grip, getting 2 credits for each program trashed that way.
Hmm.
So it's a zero-cost event that can get you 10 credits. That's really good. And then you need a lot of card draw in order to get those 5 programs in hand. And then you've also trashed all your programs that you want to play with Monolith. So you want Leviair Lab access.
Gotcha. So you kind of like cycle through your deck the first time just to use Freelance Coding Contract and get a ton of money.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes you even cycle through twice just getting money and running as you need to.
And this is out of Chaos Theory, right? So you have a deck size of 40?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the consistency is important. And also she has an extra memory. So there are a lot of like sort of silver bullet programs that you can throw down without worrying about it too much.
Hmm. Has it changed from that?
It has. When Terminal Directive came out, there was a card in there called Laguna Velasco District.
Ooh, Magnum Dropus, where you get to draw 2 cards with a click, right?
Yeah. I was able to remove all of my card draw from the deck except that, which freed up a lot of slots. One of like the good efficiency principles of the game that I learned from self-modifying code is
talking about Code Marvelous.
Yeah, thanks.
Gotcha. And he's got the YouTube channel self-modifying code where
that's what I was thinking.
Tries out lots of different decks and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, is if your draw engine is click heavy, then you don't want your economy to be click heavy.
Oh.
So I took out Magnum Opus to make room for Lugin of Velasco. And so that freed up a lot of card slots that I was able to fill with Drip Economy, which made it much easier to get to 18 credits. So I was able to draw more consistently, and I was able to get to 18 credits faster. So,
what kind of economy are you using in that?
I've got data folding and daily casts, as well as freelance coding contract. I'm still doing that whole trash a bunch of programs thing for the bursts. But with daily casts and data folding, it's pretty common for me to be dripping four every turn,
yeah,
which is super strong. So this deck is a lot more consistent and consistently faster at putting Monolith down than the PKSK version.
Interesting.
I've had it down turn three a couple of times, and it's common for it to be down turn five.
So something I wanted to point out was you're still playing this in...
It is still Chaos Theory.
So if it's in Chaos Theory, you get the extra MU, plus Monolith gives you the three MU, so your data folding can stay online for a long time, because you still have the two free MU to get that to red.
That makes data folding way better. Plus, I've got two copies of Monolith in the deck, which in a 40-card deck, you're going to see if you have Lugin of Velasco down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can get it down pretty fast.
Mulligan for Lugin of Velasco, that's the takeaway?
Yeah, if that's down turn one, then you can start drawing and slamming down the freelance coding contracts and putting down your drip economy. And before you know it, you have three programs and 20 credits.
Wow. So why do you like playing this deck? What's really fun about it for you?
Definitely that it plays the most expensive card in the game is incredibly fun. I love that a lot. If they come out with a more expensive card, I'm going to...
You're going to try using that more expensive card.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I also really like, in the old version, I really liked just cycling through my deck an entire time just for money, basically. Like, that's wild. And if people, you know, haven't seen the deck before, there's this whole sense of what are you doing over there.
Even if you have played against it, though, there's still a sense of like, God, I can't believe that is what he's doing.
Yeah, that's awesome. The new one, it doesn't need to levy nearly as much. You don't have to cycle through your deck in order to get the money to put down Monolith. So the main reason you levy is to get back those programs you trashed with freelance coding contract.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, it's still just a much different game plan than most decks have, which is interesting to me. And it's also like, you know, it's a much different game plan that isn't just a combo, or which isn't like a bad thing, but like, you know, some combos, it's just like you're trying to set up a board state where they can't possibly win anymore.
Right.
I'm just trying to set up a really unorthodox rig, basically.
Yeah, and then you just play good Netrunner once you've got that set up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems good. Seems good. So we've got that link in the show notes down below. So if that sounds like a fun deck for you to play, then definitely try it out, you know? There's certainly lots of ways to do it, because you're basically just trying to set up a money engine in a deck that gets rewarded for playing lots of programs. But this is one way to do it, and Ben's had some success with it.
You can put pretty much any programs in there that you want to. It's incredibly modular like that. You're gonna have some icebreakers, but you're sitting there with eight memory, so you can slap down whatever you want to. Like when you played against this the other day, you had the idea of putting Maven in and then just slapping down a bunch of other programs. So it would be a seven strength Maven, and it's like what I want to be doing anyway because of Monolith.
Right.
And And so and then beyond the icebreakers, you just put in whatever tools you think are fun. I have had a lot of fun with Nerve Agent in this deck.
Nerve Agent's a good card. People kind of forget about it, but yeah. It's a lot of fun to use.
Nerve Agent is medium, but for HQ.
Right. And I like putting it into a Shaper deck, because usually you don't think of Shapers challenging HQ that much. So it's often pretty lightly defended, and then you can just hammer at it, which is cool.
I think the one time that I put down Monolith turn 3 was one of my favorite Netrunner moments so far.
That is impressive. I'll give you that.
It was shortly after I put Laguna into the deck, and I was like, whoa, this is a resounding success. Turns out he doesn't do that well, but it was really exciting at the time.
It's almost like your win condition is just to get down Monolith as soon as possible, and after that, who cares? It doesn't matter. I installed Monolith.
Is put down Monolith. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining me and coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, dude. So you can find us at least twice a month at shipmentfromshiloh.podomatic.com. You can shoot me a tweet at GrahamCrackerGo. My username on all things Netrunner is PureFlight. Thanks to Foundation for the amazing theme music, and thanks to you, our avid listener, for tuning in. That's our show. This is Graham Carlson signing off for the night. Stay safe, New Angeles, and join us next time on Shipment from Shiloh.
I'm recording a podcast right now with Graham.
What up?
Hey, Graham. What's up?
What's up?
How you doing?
Great, man. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I can't find my apartment keys that I have to return to the apartment person by Friday.